20 to 30 years when it started. So if we are moving at this rate, I don't think we'll reach anywhere. So we need to have those voices turn into decisions, those concerns turn into actions, and those recommendations turn into policies. Yeah.
I found this quote that I think really speaks to what you're saying. And it's by the former president of Ireland and longtime climate change and gender equality activist, Mary Robinson, who suggested that we can understand climate change as a man-made problem, which means that it requires a feminist solution, right? You can't, and it plays off that idea that, you know, you can't solve the problem with the mind that made it. You have to look outside and you know, go outside the box. And, you know, when we're talking about requiring a feminist solution, obviously an intersectional feminist solution, because there's problems if we're just looking at it from, you know, what white feminism might mean to the people who are the most adversely affected. And as you said, you know, to look at this idea of gender through a more fluid, expanded lens of what that might mean. Because, you know, we know that oftentimes, you know, folks who are unrepresented in the mainstream and you know, living on the margins are also living on the margins of social safety, you know, whether that's, you know, in areas that are, you know, like the ground might be polluted, or, you know, like that suburb is built on on bad land kind of, or, you know, it doesn't have the same level of sanitation, or, you know, like these things that we take for granted as, you know, urban modern realities that, you know, we all have a right to.
Absolutely. And I think when we were talking about this, you said that sanitation and all these invisible issues tend to come up, which we don't think about them. But there are still so many people who have their living based off on picking fruits, and those people who still like get buckets of water from like a nearby lake or river. So if that lake or river dries up, what are they going to live off from? So they don't have access to water. They don't have proper sanitation, water supply that is reliable. So when we think about climate change, it is easy to sort of like think about it from where we are at the present and from like our present situations. But unfortunately, we don't think about the other. So this idea of people who are not like us, or like who we don't, or we think about them as far away. So what about those people? Like, that is something that is very interesting and important to think. And like climate change and is very important to talk in the sense of climate equity. So those people who are already discriminated against, who are already marginalized in the sense that they are limited in the access to resources, they are limited in, you know, monetizing on those resources. How are they like going to live? How is the landscape changing for them? That is a very important question. And it is interesting to see how like big oil companies like and industrial, you know, big names show up at climate and COP conferences, like the OPEC nations, and they say that, which is fine at one hand. It's important to have like a green and just transition. So this idea of like first creating new jobs, creating a transition, which is good for all. But we have heard from those people for so long. When are we going to hear and do something from the other side of things? Yeah.
That I feel is a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
That, you know, neither you or I have our you know, queen of the nation hat on, and you know, we can't just dictate that these great things will happen, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, like, we as people have so much power with us. Like, even if we... I'm just going to like segue a little bit and talk about how like we think about climate change in terms of like individual actions. So you recycle, you reuse stuff, and you take public transit over maybe, you know, your own car. So you carpool and stuff. That is all good. You're not taking as many international flights as you were taking before because you're more climate conscious, let's say. But your individual actions are not enough. We need to take collective actions, which means making climate change a political agenda, which means bringing this up for the politicians, for the people in the government to talk about it. That is where the people's power come in. If we are talking about climate change, if we are conscious about it, and we come together to talk about it, then perhaps we can make a change, and it's not the only one person who has the queen's crown can dictate change. We all could. And we have done before, like in the civil rights movement and in trans rights movements. We have done it before. If we come together, we can make it happen. It's just like we are aware of it, but we are not enough aware of it that we need to, you know, make this collective action. Yeah.
In the playlist, actually, where I found the Greta Thunberg climate song with the band 1975 that we heard, there's Patti Smith, who's, you know, punk rock's poet laureate, and her anthem "Power to the People," which, you know, is exactly what you're talking about. You know, that we often forget that, you know, our politicians work for us.
Yeah.
You know, and that they don't work for the oil lobby, or they don't work for the other big money.
Yeah.
Corporations that, you know, buy their popularity.
Like, think as to like they work with money and for money, but at the end of the day, if we are making choices as a consumer to not like sort of put money in those organizations and buy those products. So this idea of thinking both as a consumer and a citizen of the society. So as a citizen, you vote, you politically organize, and as a consumer, you consume things which are more sustainable, which are more organic, which are more coming from your, you know, neighborhood and not being shipped from, like, let's say, another country. So this idea of being both consumer and citizen and this power of people definitely is something very, very important. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just looking at the time, which is about 20 minutes to the hour, I want to get to these four points that are... So the question was, what would a feminist vision of climate policy look like? And the Generation Equality Action Coalition on Feminist Action for Climate Justice suggested there were four sort of platforms or, you know, four ways to invest in making climate policy look more feminist. And I think that they're really good. I think it's really good advice.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is that an inclusive and regenerative green economy recognizes the interconnectedness of climate change with issues of gender justice and protects and amplifies the voices of grassroots and indigenous communities, including frontline defenders across social and political arenas. Well, I just want to say that that is such a big fail in Canada right now that we should be embarrassed. There, if you haven't seen it, maybe you do or don't want to go watch it, but the Narwhal, which is a climate journalism publication, and they put out some really great work. They made a little video on their action to take the RCMP to court, because the RCMP had arrested one of their journalists in Wet'suwet'en. Broke down the door first with a gun and then with an axe and arrested their journalist. And so the video is a little bit about, you know, how do we protect democracy in the Fifth Estate? But it's also really shows, right, that this idea of protecting and amplifying the voices of grassroots and indigenous communities and frontline defenders is critical in the struggle for climate justice, right? And if we can't even get there,
Yeah. Well, one of our SFU professors also got arrested as they contested the TMX pipeline here. And we organized a Hug the Mountain campaign last year, and I'm looking forward to other things that might happen this year. But for people and scientists and all those frontline defenders of truth, if I were to put it that way, yeah, we are actually really failing. I don't have better words to say. And all these targets that we are setting, 2030, 2050, what are we doing to do? What are we, I don't know, planning to do? Are those just targets, or are we assuming that something's actually going to happen there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The second point on this Generation Equality Action Coalition's list is that the participation of women and girls in their full diversity, equitability, and meaningfully are at the decision-making processes at all levels.
Something I think that we really talked about. So giving them voice, giving that platform is really good, but are you giving them agency? And I think this point really hammers it home and says, you know, give them a meaningful voice in decision making and not just make room for them. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And, you know, when I gave the statistics of, 80% of women and girls are adversely affected by climate crisis, climate change, climate in general, whereas only 33% of the presenters at the last COP were women, you know, the disparaging ratio there, mm-hmm. Between the people who are affected and need to have a voice because they can speak from, you know, this grassroots voice that is proposed to be protected and amplified, can be be heard in the process.
Mm. And I also think it really relates to the first point, which is protecting the frontline. And why women and girls are at the frontline is something that we need to think from the idea that it's the systemic barriers or the way the system works that they are at the frontline. So, for example, gender-based violence, let's take that and see if there was supposed to be like a drought, let's say somewhere near us or around us. So who is sort of going to have to bear the brunt first? It is the women who have to raise the families, who have to like take care sort of after the children and after the elderly. So she does not have water for cooking and she does not have water for drinking. And so she does not have access to transportation. She does not have access to, let's say, getting out of the situation. And gender-based violence, this inequity to access of infrastructure is something that really relates to them being sort of vulnerable and at the front line of the crisis.
Mm-hmm. This also makes me think about education, right?
For sure.
Because, you know, if we're talking about bringing in women and girls in the full diversity and equitability and meaningfulness in the decision-making process at all levels, that requires women and girls to, you know, have a certain level of education where they might have confidence enough to get up in front of a bunch of men in suits and speak their piece, right? And to be able to do that in a clear and concise and even researched sort of way. And, you know, one of the things that really falls off the map for girls in areas where climate crisis hits is their access to education for various reasons, right? As you mentioned, Pranjali, you know, sometimes mamas and families just need more hands to resource the things that they need to survive, right? Sometimes it means that the school was wiped out by a hurricane and everybody is picking up debris and, you know, trying to rebuild their lives. So, you know, the reasons for that are various, but that education piece, I think, is really important. And, you know, we know that girls are generally have less access to education in general. And when there's need in the home or when there's need in the community and in the family, the girls are usually the ones to stay home and do the help, you know, especially if the mom dies or, you know, something in the climate crisis, then, you know, those girls will step into those roles, right? And their education, it's not even put on hold.
It's just like stops.
Yeah.
And it's also like already very bad for the folks in the Global South. It's the ratio of literacy between girls and boys is really, really low. Like people struggle, girls struggle in there to get until their education until 10th grade. So let aside this idea of like having access to English and communicating with people from New York. So,
right?
I mean, yeah. No, yeah, that is something and that could be improved with in general training, so you don't have to like have access to like schools, because I know in Global South schooling or like having places to go to study or like even books is not something that you really have an access to. It's a privilege. So, you know, maybe just like having trainings as if like climate preparedness and, you know, giving them tools to express, because they are the ones experiencing them. So they should be the ones expressing it to us.
Mm-hmm.
No, I like my wordplay.
The third aspect requires financing institutions and the donor community to reframe risk, prioritize women's organizations as priority partners, and for them to be held accountable to shift capital to support resilient societies and transformative investments in gender-just, climate, and ecosystem-based approaches. I really like this one because, I think part of the argument that we hear about green jobs, right, green economy. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's, you know, there's a lot of financial risk to, you know, spend this heap load of money and, you know, what's going to guarantee this or that, and we're already invested in this. And so risk management is something that is definitely part of the conversation here.
Yeah.
And it's challenging to reframe how we think about risk. But my God, if we don't think about the risk of climate, we could all just die. Seems like a pretty big risk.
That is so true. But like, if you're thinking from like a financial or like an investment risk on like government's behalf, I think especially the government of the United States, they have put in so much money into venture capitalists and the Silicon Valley, where there was no surety of the results. So they have done before, like spending so many billions blindly on getting an app which would, you know, have like a billion users. So why can't they do that with the climate change? So when we think about creating OpenAI and, you know, all these ChatGPTs and like artificial intelligence and stuff, like we're spending so much in there. What if we think about a place where this artificial intelligence actually works? And yeah, something to think about too. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. The fourth aspect highlights the need for women and girls in all their diversity to be able to equitably access climate finance, technologies, and knowledge, and access and control natural resources for management and protection, including through securing land rights and ownership. And this is also big, right? Because unless you're really living in a matrilineal society, which there are few and far between in this day and age, because, well, we won't name the culprit, but women's land ownership and women's access to financing is few and far between.
Yeah. And I was reading somewhere, I don't remember where, but for UN and its related climate change wings, you have to be owner of a certain amount or like piece of land before you can like participate in the discussions and represent your community. So if you were to be, let's say, UN's climate community representative from, let's say, any country, you have to like own a certain piece of land. So this idea of inheritance of land is very masculine, especially when I talk about countries in Asia and Africa. So this again, I think, bleeds into the systemic barriers of representation and of taking action. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I know that we've just got five more minutes in the program, and I do have one last song that maybe we want to end on, which is 4 minutes long. So, okay. Closing remarks on our discussion. Where do we go?
Eventually.
How do we solve this issue?
How do we solve it? Well, you have to listen to me on that for like an hour, but I would just say think about like climate justice and equity, which means when you think about climate crisis, you cannot let go of the other crisis and other biases and discriminations that are happening. So climate change is not very different from the effects that colonization and like gender discrimination has on us. So when we think about climate change, we need to think about the intersection of all these things. Is what I mean. And please go beyond the individual actions and think of the ways you could come together collectively as a community and do something, because that is what is going to bring the change. Yes.
Yes. I don't know that I can wrap that up any better.
No, that was my two-pointer thing. But thank you so much for listening to us. And thank you so much, Robin, for having me here.
Well, thanks for bringing this topic to the table today. Super important, and you know, obviously, not something that you know can be discussed in 1 hour. There's lots and lots to sort of dig into. But you know, as you encouraged listeners to do, you know.
Get out in the community and connect.
Yeah. And learn and
you know, talk about it, I guess.
Make conscious choices in terms of you know, your power to the people, spending power and all of that kind of stuff.
And the political power.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna end with a track called Sing the Water Song. And this is I believe it's Algonquin. Stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming up after this. And thanks for listening.
Granddaughter, the water can hear you. The water has memory. Life's blood of our mother, the earth. Water is the lifeblood of our own body. On the knowledge that needs to be given unto the other generations. You are the keeper of the water.
Life condition that we're in, that great grandchildren will stand up to this truth of what life is about and to live it in such an honorable way, the way ancestors came to this earth.